Hey, this is Matt Hawkins, and you're listening to the Top Cow Chronology Project.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This is a Top Cow Thursday episode, and it's going to finish off the Top Cow Chronology Project coverage of Tomb Raider Journeys. I'm going to be talking about issues 11 and 12. But before I get to that, for those of you not familiar with the Top Cow Chronology Project, it's kind of the way this whole podcast got started. Basically, I'm a huge Michael Turner fan, and he was the original artist on the Witchblade series from Top Cow. And I bought a huge omnibus one time, never read it, but always planned on it. And then gradually over the years, became even more of a Top Cow fan when I picked up Think Tank from writer Matt Hawkins and met some of the people over there at Top Cow and just, became friends with them and loved a lot of their properties, but had never gone back and read that stuff from their artifact universe. And cruising around on the internet one night and came across this chronology, this reading order from a user who goes by the name of Condor over on the Comic Vine website. And this wasn't an order of publishing. It wasn't the order the books had been published in, but rather was a reading order based on history, right? So the oldest issues or the first issues in the reading order were ancient Egypt and times in the past all the way up through present day. So I thought, wow, this would be really cool. It's a great way to discover the artifact universe, the artifact corner of the Top Cow universe, and read these books that I've never read before. And then what I can do is I can actually, as soon as I read one of the books, I can immediately record a podcast about it. So you're getting my first initial reactions, and I thought it would be something really cool to do. So I took a break for a while. Honestly, part of it had to do with just other priorities, with other things I wanted to podcast about, but also this Tomb Raider Journeys series has been a little tough to get through. It's been a little up and down, and also the fact that it doesn't tie in that closely to the rest of the Top Cow universe. You know, at the time that Top Cow published these, they had the license to Tomb Raider, and that license since has moved over to Dark Horse. So if you're actually looking for these books, you won't find them in a collection or digitally, just because Top Cow never reprinted them because they, as I said, they no longer have the license. So if you are looking for these books, which I can't in good conscience recommend you to go out and look for them. But if you are looking for them, you know, check out your local comic shop, eBay, maybe a convention. If you do find them, they're not particularly expensive. But unlike a lot of the other material that we cover on the Top Cow Chronology Project, as I said, it's not available in trade. Like Witchblade, Darkness, all that kind of stuff is readily available and in print from Top Cow, but unfortunately this is not. So let me get on to the issue itself. Again, start with Tomb Raider Journeys number 9, the creative team. It's written by Fiona Kai Avery. The pencils are by Manny Clark. The inks are by Marlo Alqueza. And the colors on this issue are by Brian Buccioletto, Tyson Wengler, and Steve Furchow. So if you remember at the end of last issue, Miles, who we find, who we learned in the last issue was kind of a mentor to Laura, kind of showed her the Tomb Raiding ropes, if you will. He'd been thrown off a cliff into this chasm in the dream world, the dreaming underworld, by Kagan, who's been Laura's antagonist throughout this entire series. Kagan had destroyed the bridge that Laura crossed to obtain a weapon that she could use in the dream world. So he had destroyed this bridge, one of these song lines that Miles and Lara and Akio had been traveling across, and then threw Miles over the edge. So this issue begins with Miles falling. Laura's obviously distraught. She says it's bad enough that Kagan would destroy one of the song lines, a vital, life-sustaining, esoteric feeder to the realm of the living. But then he throws Miles off and he has to be stopped. So she's kind of looking across the chasm at Kagan, and then Akio appears on that side and says that he is the servant of the earth and it's time for Kagan to pay. And he actually knocks Kagan into the chasm as well. And Laura questions Akio and says, why did you let them both? And Akio stops right there, says, they're not dead. Nothing in here is as it seems. Your friend Miles is already dead, so he will survive the fall, as will Kagan. And then Akio casts a spell that restores the songline that Kagan had destroyed. So Laura crosses, joins him, and says, take me to where Kagan is now if he has indeed survived. So Akio agrees, but says that they may not return from the dreaming underworld alive, but Laura says that she wants to take that chance. So they actually start traveling through what's known as the Blue Fires, which apparently isn't a particularly pleasant experience because Laura says that she learned to breathe ice-hot coals. And also, as they travel this way throughout the dream underworld, it has effects on the real world, the reverberations of their travel, I guess you'd say. So we see some earthquakes, we see some volcanic eruptions, we see some storms at sea that are all apparently caused by this speedy way to travel that Akio and Laura have decided to undertake in the dreaming underworld. So there's a few pages of art here which are pretty solid, a lot of blue, a lot of electricity, a lot of lightning, and eventually Akio delivers Laura to where Kagan is, and he's kind of floating above where they are in this blue fire / lightning, and Laura tries to get to him, but she's continually thwarted by the crackling of the lightning. She just doesn't seem to be able to find a way in, and she doesn't understand why. And Akio tells her that it's basically because she's carrying around the weight of all her past mistakes, and they bind her from getting close to Kagan. So Laura says that she'll sever them with the invisible sword that she has, and as she starts to kind of cut away at these, bolts of lightning or shafts of lightning, she starts having flashbacks, and there are actually scenes with Kagan that we've seen throughout the series where she's first met him and teamed up with him and invariably ends up kind of thwarting him and leaving him behind, leaving him tied up, never fully trusting him. And so that continues for a few pages as Laura severs more and more of these lines. It has more flashbacks, and we even, as she severs some of the bolts of lightning, we get their relationship from Kagan's point of view, which is interesting. There seemed to be some romantic undertones, but apparently these two have been fighting for centuries. I guess they're reincarnated selves, or maybe it has to do with the fact they're both in the dreaming, since time really has no meaning there. But eventually Laura is able to reach Kagan, and they have a battle, and Laura is able to best him with somewhat relative ease, and Kagan expects to be, I think, kind of killed, although it's unclear if he can be killed in this dreaming. But Laura says no, that's not what her purpose is. And so then Akio says, well, then he's going to be the one to serve justice. But Laura prevents that from happening and instead says she's going to do what's not expected and actually protect him, because she feels like Kagan isn't a bad person. He's just misguided. And it was actually Laura's mistake, because she put him away so many times throughout the centuries, left him to die or tied up. She never really gave him a chance, never protected him. So Akio seems to go along with this, and they start preparing to leave the dream world when Miles shows back up, and Laura asks if, or tells him he can't have the dream sphere because earlier in the series he had said he wanted to obtain the dream sphere himself because it could return him to the land of the living. But Miles says no, that's not what he's after. He actually just showed up to give Laura a vital piece of information, whispers in her ear, and the issue ends. So it's a relatively fast-paced issue. You know, the fight between Laura and Kagan takes up quite a few pages. The flashback she had takes up quite a few pages. So that's probably why, and there are a lot of big panels, so that's probably why it seems to go by relatively quickly. What's interesting is the way this issue ended, or with the resolution of the whole dream sphere storyline, and Laura being able to retrieve that and defeating Kagan, I kind of felt like that would be like the climax of the series. Like, okay, it's pretty much over at that point, right? Maybe you get another two or three, maybe even four pages of just tying up the loose ends and kind of, you know, putting all the pieces back on the shelf, I guess you'd say. So I was kind of surprised that it all got resolved in this issue. It's one of the better issues. You know, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, this series tends to be a little up and down, uneven for me, both in writing and art. But I felt like this was one of the better ones. It was a little choppy over the first few pages, but the resolution I enjoyed, and it made sense. And, you know, Fiona Kai Avery, her dialogue's always good. It's more the pacing of the plot that kind of drags it down sometimes. But, you know, other than, like I said, very little bit of choppiness in the first couple pages, I thought this issue was well done. The art's well done as well, although one thing I noticed is that in this particular issue, Manny Clark seems to draw Laura a little more voluptuous, a little more well-endowed than I remember in previous issues. I mean, that's not necessarily a new thing for Laura Croft, but I didn't think Manny Clark was really doing it so overtly as he is in this issue. But colors are really cool. The flashbacks are in like this black and white or almost a sepia tone. You know, a lot of blues. The lightning has a nice glow to it. So the color work is done really, really well. So enjoyed this issue. It was nice to see a resolution. But again, I was left wondering, okay, well, so then what are we going to do in issue 12? Maybe it's got something to do with what Miles had to tell Laura on that last page, that last panel there. So let's move on to issue 12. Creative team, written by Fiona Kai Avery. The art in this issue is by Moon Kai Tan. Inks by Marlo Alqueza. And colors by Tyson Wengler. So there's actually been a few months, I guess, since the end of the last episode, which isn't readily apparent because this episode opens up and we're at Laura's house. She's sitting by the fire. She's thinking about saying bye to Miles as she was carrying Kagan out of the dream world and leaving Akio as well. And then Kagan shows up, and throughout the dialogue with them talking, we come to realize that Kagan's actually been working for Laura for quite a while here, trying to dig up information on just who it was that killed Miles. So apparently that's something to do with what Miles told Laura at the end of last issue. So we find out that the Miles killer is Mr. Charles Carlton, a billionaire. At one time worked for British intelligence, spy for certain, and possibly a double agent. And he finds out that he's living on the island of Antigua. And so Laura says, all right, let's take my private jet and go find out. So they jump on the jet, they're traveling there. Kagan is talking about what exactly Laura's plan is. And Laura's not quite ready to tell him. She doesn't quite trust him yet. He mentions that being locked in his room for the first few nights after they returned from the dreaming wasn't enough to convince her, but she says that it wasn't. We also learn that Laura actually still has a little bit of the Moko, the tribal tattoos that allowed her to travel in the dream world. And doesn't know why it's still there on her wrist, but it is, and she's not sure, and she kind of hides the fact that it's still there. So they arrive in Antigua, and they go to a party at the ambassador's estate that Charles Carleton is throwing, and they're actually at Carleton's table, of course. And throughout the party, Laura kind of charms him, and they dance together and talk, and Laura gets herself invited back to his estate. Kagan's a little wary because, again, Laura wouldn't apprise him of what her plans are. So he follows. He's worried about her because she doesn't necessarily seem to be acting like herself or the way he has seen her act in the past. So they get to Carleton's mansion, I guess you'd say, and Laura asks to see his collection of antiquities. And as she's taking off her coat, we see that Carleton notices the tattoo, the Moko, the tribal tattoo that's still around her wrist. And it's very obvious. It's a good job by Tan with the art to not make it extremely overt, but to make it clear that he notices the tattoo and he has a reaction. So we see as he goes to hang up her coat that Carleton actually pushes a hidden button and then leads Laura into the antiquities room, starts pointing out where he got this artifact or that. Laura asks about one particular piece, and Carleton said, "Oh, that one's very special. Yes, I actually killed a man to get that one. He was going to get it before I could get my hands on it. He'd stolen it and other information from me in order to reach it first." And Carleton says he was unscrupulous and evil. He didn't care for anyone or anything, and the world's a better place without him. And Laura mentioned something about speaking so bad of him. Aren't you worried that his ghost will come back to haunt you? And then she pulls out a gun and says, "Do you know whose gun this is?" And Carleton takes a step back, and Laura says that it's the only family she ever had was that evil man, and that's actually his gun. And it turns out that Carlton's the one that stole from Miles and bribed officials and cheated his way into obtaining that artifact that Miles should have been the one to find. He doesn't seem particularly scared, though, and we find out why when Laura gets shot. Now, the only problem I have with that is Carlton pushed the button, he was calling for his guards. And Laura's there, has the gun on Carlton. She's not moving at all. And yet, who's ever firing at her, all it does is graze her shoulder. Talk about a terrible shot. I mean, she wasn't even moving. Anyway, Laura drops the gun, and we see as the gun falls out of her hand that the Moko, the tattoo, detaches itself from her wrist, holds the gun up, and fires, hitting Carlton and killing him. And then the gun clatters to the ground, and it looks like the Moko is kind of fading out. And Laura's very surprised. She's like, "I didn't touch the gun. The Moko, it did kind of on its own." And then crash, bang, boom. Kagan is there firing at the other guards. And they run off. And then Kagan asks Laura if she shot Carlton, and she said no. She's not really sure what happened, but the tattoo seemed to come off and it basically held the gun aloft and shot Carlton. And Kagan asked her if she knows what that means, and she said she's not sure, but she has a vague idea. And so they leave. And 2 weeks later, Laura's standing in front of Miles' tomb, kind of with a pensive look on her face, thoughtful look on her face, and Akio shows up. And Laura says, "I must be dreaming." And Akio says, "I'll always hear your call in your dreams." And then she starts talking about the Moko and asks Akio, "Was it him?" And Akio says that the Moko is a pattern that spells out your personality, your spirit, and it's definitely possible that Miles knew that, and he kind of existed somewhere within that Moko that remained on Alora's wrist. And he basically used his knowledge of Maori spells to kind of keep a part of himself in that Moko as a way of transferring and having some influence on the waking world. So basically he got his revenge by kind of hitchhiking on Laura's tattoo. But in a way it's good, and it was a way for Miles to protect Alora one last time, because the blood's not really on her hands. You know, she kept her promise to Miles. His death is avenged, but Alora wasn't the one that, you know, had to do it. So her spirit is intact, so to speak. So that's the way the story ends. The final page is Alora bending over to kiss Miles' tombstone and saying, I will not see you again, and I will always be seeing you. So again, I kind of felt like the way issue 11 ended was kind of the big climax. And this is almost like epilogue. Don't know that it was necessarily needed, because it's just strange that, you know, Miles, he only got introduced a couple of issues ago. And for this plot line of his revenge to be, you know, added in just at the very end, it doesn't really have as much impact as if it had been a thread that had been throughout the whole series. So it makes it seem a little bit like an afterthought. So again, it just goes back to the kind of the unevenness of the story. I feel like the story would have had a little more impact if it kind of ended and the major climax was the battle between Laura and Kagan and resolving that. And, you know, I don't mind a few pages of epilogue, but this, I don't know, it just seemed a little strange to me. It didn't really flow. I think it could have been done better. But all in all, not a terrible series. I have to be honest with you, I'm glad it's over, though. I'm glad we're going to be getting back to stories that are Top Cow Artifact Universe proper. In fact, the next books in the chronology is the first volume of Witchblade. Now, one thing Manny and I did decide to do, since we, again, weren't familiar at all with any of the Top Cow Artifact Universe when we started the Top Cow Chronology Project, is we actually started with Witchblade, the first volume, just because that was, in publishing order, what was first. Even though, as I said, we were using Condor's chronology, which is, you know, historical chronology, not a publishing chronology. But we wanted to read what came first as far as publishing-wise, just to get our feet wet. So I will still go over that first volume of Witchblade, but we're going to be moving on from it very quickly. We're not going to do like we do with most of the issues and do one episode per. I may just do one or two to kind of recap and go over. And if you're reading along, I mean, any excuse to go back and read early Witchblade, you know, Michael Turner art, David Wall writing, and I know Top Cow sometimes, their 90s stuff gets a bad rap for being bad girl comics, but I think that's not really deserved. I think that kind of talk is usually from people who haven't actually read it, because Sarah is actually a pretty strong character. She, you know, not that it's not of its time somewhat, but Sarah Pazzini is a good female role model. She's a strong female character. You know, maybe the art is a little bad girl, but, you know, it's Michael Turner art, like I said. So, I mean, I love that. I really enjoyed it when we first read it. I loved the first volume of Witchblade, read it several times since then. So it's never a bad thing in my mind to go back and reread it. So we'll definitely be talking about that next time on the Top Cow Chronology Project. So that does it for this episode. Please go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for us on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on convention coverage, and we always are sure to let you know when we release new episodes. on Facebook and Instagram. So be sure and tune in there. And don't forget about our exclusive podcast, The 9-Panel Grid, over on LRM Online. And while you're there, check out all the other content on LRM Online, covering all manner of pop culture, TV, movies, comics, just about anything you can think of. So thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.